We lived in a place where cable didn't exist. Our water was pumped from a well, our electricity streaming in on a TVA river wave. Dirt roads ribboned through our hills, where people were all but waiting on a filmmaker to document their poverty.
Today on Arts and Letters, we'll be talking with Arkansas writer and winner of the Sherwood Anderson Fiction Award, Woody Skinner.
We lived in Izard County, Arkansas, but we had a satellite dish in our front yard. A marvel of engineering, a jellyfish puffing toward the sky.
His short story collection, A Thousand Distant Radios, published by Atelier 26 Books, explores the distances both real and imagined between us. Woody Skinner, A Thousand Distant Radios, Oscillating Waves, and his story, Preferred Signals, 1985, on Arts and Letters.
G6, the East Coast News. In the mornings, before I left for school, we'd angle the TV so we could see from the breakfast room. We usually watched the East Coast News, reports from places fathomable only in two colorful dimensions, weather map geography. My father liked to hear horror stories of the human variety, robberies and rapes and murders. He said we needed to hear them.
It's healthy to be reminded of our ugliness.
From the studios of KUAR in Little Rock, I'm J. Bradley Minnick, and welcome to Arts and Letters, a program providing opportunities for a celebration of the arts and humanities. Today, we'll be featuring a short story entitled Preferred Signals, 1985. From Arkansas writer Woody Skinner's award-winning collection, A Thousand Distant Radios.
I would listen to the somber tone of broadcasters, their words drowned out by the sizzle and pop of fried meat.
The story considers the limitations of language, the semiotics of preferred signals that both stand between us and bring us together.
My father would pull baskets of meat and potatoes from the deep fryer, all of it soggy, grease dripping down your cuticles before dripping down your throat. What are we eating today, I'd ask.
Cheetah meat,
he'd say.
Woody Skinner, native of Batesville, Arkansas, PhD in comparative literature, and winner of the Sherwood Anderson Fiction Award. Welcome.
Thank you.
So tell us just a little bit about this book, A Thousand Distant Radios. We had talked about how being from a small town, which you are, not a super small town, but a small town, the idea of being very isolated and at the same time having access to the world through television and computers, does that predominate this?
I think it does. I think it's one of the central tensions in the book because I felt growing up, my favorite TV show was Seinfeld. And by the time I was 10 or 11, I think that we had internet in our home. And so there was this sense that there was a bigger world out there and that I was connected to it. And yet all of that felt really far away.
But you were able to see the world through these images.
I felt like I was able to. I think I was able to see a particular presentation of the world through pop culture stuff. And I think that I was just sort of a curious kid, and so especially once we had the internet, I felt really in a way like there were two separate strands, and I think maybe those strands are in the book. And there's very much an Arkansas self where I grew up hunting and fishing and playing baseball, and that was a huge part of my childhood. But at the same time, I guess I had sort of creative curiosities, and I definitely had the sense that I wanted, even though I felt very connected to Arkansas upbringing, I had the sense that I wanted to get out of Arkansas and go experience something else.
Tell us a little bit about preferred signals. It seems like many of these stories, but particularly this one, there's a distance.
Mm-hmm.
There's not only a distance between the character and the television shows and the news and tennis and French cinema that he's watching with his father, but there's a distance between he and his father.
Yes, absolutely. I think there's also a distance in the perspective of the story because it's a long retrospective point of view, so the narrator's really looking back. And I think that distance in some ways, even that point of view is sort of an odd choice for a story like this because you might normally want to address the subject matter with an intimacy and a closeness and a proximity. Usually a long retrospective point of view is used to look back and kind of see the things that you weren't able and willing to see. And I feel like in this story, I'm looking back and I feel like there are maybe gestures toward that, and yet I'm not sure that the narrator ever gets a tidy sense of closure about fully understanding his father,
right,
or fully understanding the place that he grew up. So I do think that there's a distance between the father and son, and I think some of it is just in how the son is trying to use something like TV to connect with his father. We were a space-age family, my father liked to say. He was an expert dish adjuster, a champion of signal, a skill born of practice, dedication, more than science. Out there in our front yard, in the space between fat oak trees, my father shaped masterpieces, our dish's antenna locked on to distant targets, sending pristine picture to our television. We watched until our eyes ached.
This is Arts and Letters. We're talking with Woody Skinner about his short story, Preferred Signals, 1985. There's an art of his father's in preparing and setting up satellite dishes.
Right. He's very particular about it. To him, he takes pride in the quality of the signal he's getting. And much of this is highly fictionalized. The science behind the way that satellites are working in the story isn't necessarily accurate, but it felt somehow emotionally accurate, I suppose.
And we're talking about the marvel of engineering, which is the satellite dish.
It's framed stiff, shiny, a monument to mass communication. According to my father, we were devotees of manufacturing, people who made an art out of industry. The satellite dish, the Buick, the trailer, our lives made of metals.
Your lives were made of metals. Buicks, satellite dishes, trailers, metals everywhere.
I think that at some point when I was a kid, I looked around and I realized that most of the buildings that were being built in Batesville, and most especially commercial space, I guess it's 10, I'm not sure what it is, but it's very utilitarian. There's not a lot of aesthetic interest in the building, but it sort of accomplishes what it needs to accomplish. It houses whatever retail space. And you see there are a lot of buildings like that, and they're just sort of striking to me because Batesville is a really old town, and so there's a strong contrast between the old buildings and the new. And I just sensed that as a kid. And I wondered why the buildings that were being built weren't brick, why they were made of these metals.
This is 1985. And 1985 is all about television. And Edmund is a 15-year-old boy. Mm-hmm. His mother has died.
My mother died during the motherly act. That's how my father explained it. He was 50 years old when I was born. He cooked for the catfish buffet over in Strawberry. He liked to wear an old fireman's coat to the restaurant, chemistry goggles strapped around his head. He looked like a villain from one of the Mexican dramas piped in through the satellite. He looked like a fellow with an obscure but absolute capacity for destruction.
Here's a juxtaposition that I find very interesting. The father is artistic about making the satellite dishes, yet he cooks catfish over there in Strawberry. And at the same time, he wears chemistry goggles strapped around his head and an old fireman's coat to the restaurant. Now, we do begin to realize that the father's ill. At first, I thought mentally ill, but we realize he's not well physically. And I'm imagining it's cancer, but I don't think you ever tip your hat to that.
Yeah, something is killing the father. I think that I also felt like having it unnamed and not being completely clear, I feel like that's not just me trying to be cagey as a writer, but somehow I find it even more menacing or ominous that it's not named. And I wanted to maintain that by not naming it, I guess.
Still, though, would you agree? Odd behavior to wear the fireman's coat and the goggles to cook in.
I was thinking about, in a almost cartoonish way, how the realities of cooking all the time. And my sister used to work briefly at a catfish restaurant in Batesville, and she would come home with arms sort of flecked with grease burns.
The fireman coat makes sense.
Yeah, exactly.
And then I guess the goggles from the grease.
Yeah, so I was thinking of that. I also think that I was working to establish the eccentricity of the father.
But then also, his father is always cutting things. Mm-hmm. Cutting off his sleeves, mm-hmm. cutting Edmund's hair.
One morning, the two of us were sitting there staring at a New York weather map when my father said,
"Looks like a heat wave's headed this way."
The map said the high in Buffalo was 67 degrees. My father walked into the kitchen, grabbed the pair of scissors he used for clipping fat from meat. He came back and faced away from me, staring at the TV. He raised the fat cake scissors and cut into the shoulder of his plaid shirt, circling his bicep until he detached the sleeve. He unbuttoned the cuff and pulled the sleeve off, tossing it onto the kitchen table next to my plate. He was halfway through the other sleeve when he said,
"Stand up, Edmund. You need some wardrobe adjustment."
I was 15 years old, and I listened to everything he said. I stood before him, and he appraised my clothes. A pair of khaki pants that were tight in the crotch, an oversized plaid shirt I'd taken from his closet. He examined my shoulder, looking back and forth, right then left. He raised the scissors and snipped above my collarbone, gaining speed as he worked around my arm. He tugged the sleeve off and dropped it to the linoleum. I stood there quietly while he cut the other sleeve and trimmed my pants at the knees.
So again, a strange moment. I like the idea he's wearing his dad's shirt.
Mm-hmm.
It's just odd.
Mm-hmm.
And it's even odd for Southern literature. And it's so odd because it's minuscule. It's almost an act of love.
Mm-hmm. I think that there's definitely love in the father's eccentricity. When I'm thinking about this now, just reading it now, I'm thinking about how it's a very intimate moment, just having his clothes cut away in that way. And I think that it's intimacy through action. So when it comes to words, his father's always evasive. I mean, the answer, cheetah meat. In that case, it's sort of functioning as kind of an evasive joke. But throughout the story, his father is sort of saying things that put distance between Edmund and the truth, but also that put distance between Edmund and the father. And so words are often kind of used to create distance, but in this case, there's intimacy in the action. So that's what I'm thinking about there, that if his father's not able to really be honest with his words, he can do so through his action.
It also seems, at least to me, that he's kind of molding the son into himself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a very fair reading of what the father would like to do.
This next paragraph is just gorgeous. And what I like is that you tell the reader that this is not happening now, even though it was in the past tense.
Right.
But we tend to do that in stories. But we recognize it's many years later, and Edmund is looking back on this and trying to make sense of it.
Mm-hmm.
Almost like a mixed-up TV signal.
Right.
Let's listen to the next paragraph.
My father's eccentricity deepened during the last year of his life. Now, so many years later, I still have the satellite chart that hung over the mantle of our faux fireplace. Its markings are celestial, dots and pins angled into shapes, an astronomy of soap operas and sporting events, foreign films and public hearings. My father's scribbles crowd the edges, noting his favorite satellites, his preferred signals. It's easy to detect the absurdity, the nihilism of his sickness now, looking back on his behaviors and obsessions. But in those days, he could tell me anything, and it was the truth. That, I've come to think, was my father's most damning illness, omniscience.
Why do you say the nihilism of his sickness?
I say it because I'm thinking of how sickness has the power to strip away some of the other ways that we make meaning, perhaps. And I think that sickness has the capacity to drastically rearrange priorities and concerns.
And brings out the truth.
Yeah, to bring out the truth, for sure.
I mean, what do you have to lose? The markings are celestial dots and pins angled in shapes, an astronomy of soap operas and sporting events. foreign films, and public hearings. Again, your juxtapositions of entertainment or fluff with something important. Mm-hmm. Is that their relationship, that even though his father tells them the truth, they can't talk about the most important thing?
I do think that's their relationship. The truth is okay at a distance, but when it's up close, passing between them, the truth is not as accessible.
It's too real.
It's too real.
So they escape into television together.
And that was one of the central challenges in this story, was using the programming. So as a writer, if you're writing a scene, you know, you want to set the scene to some degree and kind of figure out the setting. And the TV is just really essential in all of these scenes. And so you want to figure out the programming that feels right and true to the moment, but that's not heavy-handed and that the parallels aren't so direct that it seems kind of trite. F2, tennis. Tennis was always on. If not on a North American satellite, then one from Sweden or Bulgaria. My father admired the sport for its uniforms, the tight shirts and short shorts and high socks. I tried to take up tennis. While other boys my age were mastering their skill with a chainsaw, fist-fighting on the riverbank, I was tiptoeing across weed-cracked courts, swatting the air with a racket, lofting the ball over the net to my coach.
All right, let's talk about F2 tennis. His father's obsessed with just having the tennis match on. Why is it always on? And why is it usually Sweden or Bulgaria, not so much the U.S. Open? But I'm just wondering why tennis is always on.
Again, it's how the satellite connects them to the rest of the world. In general, I was thinking that the satellite's giving them access to things that wouldn't be immediately accessible. And so these tennis broadcasts from far-flung places seemed somehow appropriate to me.
This is Arts and Letters. We're talking with Woody Skinner about his short story, Preferred Signals, 1985.
Contact Hawaii, contact 100% in 1 million. Roger Hawaii, radio clear also.
One afternoon, I watched television from a folding chair while my father stood behind me with a hair clipper. On screen, a couple of European men with scrawny arms and hairy legs were slapping a tennis ball back and forth, their shoes chirping on the court. I could sense my father's distraction, the tennis match getting more attention than my hair. I sat there patiently, my father mowing a row of hair every once in a while. Be careful around my ears, I said.
That ball wasn't anywhere close to the line.
He began cutting with a bit more vigor, the blade tugging my hair, releasing it. I have a scar from last time, I said.
You're being dramatic. Cartilage hardly scars.
Is this match point, I asked. I've been playing the sport for a year and still struggle with the subtleties of scoring. The European broadcast could hardly help. My father moved in front of me, lifted my chin to look at me.
This may be my best work yet. I've highlighted your McEnroe qualities. Long enough to be rebellious, but not so long as to affect your performance. Style and substance, that's the ticket, Edmund.
What's he trying to turn him into with this haircut?
He's always kind of trying to impart these bits of wisdom. He has these strong ideas about what sort of person Edmund should be, but they're usually very fleeting. And so I feel like his father's guided by impulse. And I think that this is another instance of his father in this moment seems like he's got conviction about this, but that, like many of the other things his father says, there's not that much lasting value in it. It might sound meaningful, but in fact, it's a little bit empty.
I thought we would read a little bit about Annette. Finally, a female appears in the
right,
story. Because it's a very male story. It's an intimate male story in the sense that it's a father-son piece. Annette appears, and she breaks not only the tension, but kind of the third wall.
It was Annette Meyer, a girl so pretty she made my breastbone ache, a quarter-sized pain that lasered through to the meat of my back. Annette had buck teeth, an almond-shaped dimple in her chin, black hair so thick it must have strained the muscles in her neck. She had a couple of years on me in school, and she had the rumors that kept me sleepless at night.
Did you know a girl like Annette?
I certainly knew the familiarity of loving things from afar, and I think that this sense of longing that he feels both for his father and Annette, that's familiar to me, but it's very generalized. It's hard to pinpoint something from my life where it's like, well, that's why I have that sense of longing. But I think it's just a sense of tragedy before there's even a reason to feel it.
Moi, je trouve ça m'a va très, très bien.
So at night, after they cook catfish, Annette comes over, and what do they watch?
Patricia, t'as vu que je vous suivais hier soir?
Not tennis, but French cinema. which I mean, you just think of a 15-year-old kid, and that's probably the last thing.
Tu pensais hier soir?
F1, French cinema. Annette came over more often in those last months of my father's life. When my father stopped driving, she got her license, started making use of her mother's Kelp Ambassador. The car was low and wide, a raft over the dirt roadway, and as she drove, gravel pinged into the undercarriage. Her tires spraying the shoulders with grit. Annette treated my father like a jarred firefly, like she better savor his every blink, absorb his last light. They spent evenings in front of the television, the satellite tuned to a station that played French films. They'd sit on the couch Indian style, their knees rubbing, mimicking the roles they saw on screen, interpreting the lines. They'd laugh at the dramatic moments, the actors' expressive faces. Sometimes I'd march up to the recliner and plop down as though it was nothing to have Annette Meyer right there next to me.
Le drame, c'est que je ne sais même pas.
But I could hardly breathe.
Moi, je sais.
I certainly couldn't talk.
Personne ne sait.
I'd stare at the screen.
Je pensais hier soir.
The French people communicating big feelings.
Je voudrais penser à quelque chose, et je n'arrive pas.
The depth, the emotion of their faces, the fluttery octaves of their voices. I wasn't sure I would have understood even if I were a Frenchman. It's still difficult to fathom Annette's presence in our living room. Sure, she yearned for our television, for the international programming, but it was always more than that. My father had a way of bringing the world, the things he wanted, close to him. Perhaps it is naive of me, but I believe, even now, that nothing more than companionship passed between them. That they were simply magnificent friends. People who shared a sensibility, who bonded as they breaded fish fillets.
And then, of course, this is right in the middle of the Cold War.
G1, politics of the Soviet Union. One night, we watched the live broadcast of a Soviet congressional debate. The Soviets argued with dramatic hand gestures, flecks of spittle bursting from their lips.
This is beautiful. This is governance. These men know what it is to be powerful.
It's so erotic, Annette said. And then she and my father looked at me, laughed together. My father's lungs hopped. He laughed so hard.
The father seems to have a notion of the importance of the world, too.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is right during the Cold War. We're right in the Reagan era. And they're watching a Soviet congressional debate. I never had the opportunity to see that in 1985. Please don't count
the applause. I think that the father, he feels like it's important to understand the world, but again, it is from afar. The father just has a way of really speaking with authority and seeming like he knows about the world, perhaps even more than he does know about the world.
These pieces are put together in a cacophony, and it makes sense with the notion of the satellite.
He had his own kind of gravity, a force that pulled me into orbit, closer and closer, before I stabilized into rotation, circling him at a distance, never close enough to collide.
So these two guys are like satellites, mm-hmm. right? They're separate satellites
yep.
on different channels.
G4, Dallas. I'd come home from school hoping to watch reruns of Dallas, and my father had taken me into the front yard to the foot of our satellite dish. This was about 6 months before he died. We stared up at the sweeping rim of the dish. Up close it was big, sprouting between the trees like a giant flower, a steel lily. My father had never summoned me to the dish. He had always handled it on his own, always regarded attentions to the dish as a crucial part of his parenting philosophy. Why are we here, I asked.
Last night's storm, it knocked the dish off balance.
It looked fine to me, though I didn't know what to look for. My father placed his hand on the rim of the dish and held it there, as though he were taking its pulse. How do we straighten it out? I asked. He just stood there, staring past the dirt road into the broad field of sage across from our property. He seemed to be considering something vast and unknowable. How our television reception was affected by the steady expansion of the universe, maybe. I waited for him to say it. I waited for him to deliver one of his theories, one of those clever excuses he told me all my life. Should I crank this handle, I asked.
I'm dying.
I nodded, but I didn't believe him. I'm not sure I ever believed that he was dying. It was always so difficult to distinguish between my father's truth and the actual truth. Only in time would I understand that, standing there in the matted weeds below the dish, my father had announced a truth unsullied, that he'd sent the message as clearly as he could.
I'm going to show you how to do this.
He aligned the dish with the distant barn, and then began cranking the handle. The dish tilted back, squeaking.
We're trying to connect to the G4 satellite. You know where the G4 satellite is. You've seen it on the chart.
I watched while his forearm circled, the antenna angling toward the afternoon sun.
And the father wants to teach him something before he dies.
Yeah.
Why this? Why pointing a satellite in the proper direction?
To the father, this is really important because it's what gives him access to all of this programming that the father values, but also that brings Annette to their house. The son is really wanting to watch Dallas here. It might seem insignificant, but to the father it's really important, and actually to Edmund it's pretty important.
It also seems metaphorically that he's pointing him out to the distance and saying, there's a big world out there, kid.
Mm-hmm.
Each of these, from F4 to G2 to G3 to G4 to F1, all these are their preferred signals.
We were watching figure skating. A girl with tiny arms and hammy thighs skated around the rink, rising from the ice and spinning flourishes. My father lay on the couch, coming in and out of sleep. Annette sat at his feet, flipping through a design magazine, occasionally glancing up at the screen. I don't really like skating, she said. How do you know the judges aren't cheating? My father raised his head.
Trick sports are the purest form of athletic pursuit. There are no rules confining the athletes. They're bound only by the limits of their bodies and their imaginations.
And then we lost signal. The screen turned blue, its bewildering light shading our walls. None of us acknowledged the loss out loud. It seemed an impossibility, the three of us in that living room without any signal. I knew what needed to be done. I went outside. When I reached the receiver, I cranked the handle, adjusted the angle. I checked the living room window, hoping to see flashes of color, but the glass was tinted blue. I pushed the dish around, aimed its antenna across the sky, and still the blue remained. When I found nothing, when it seemed like I'd exhausted every starred corner of nighttime, I stopped. I stood a moment looking at the dish, pressing my hand against its rim. Its surface was dotted with cool dew. I leaned against it, testing my weight, before I pulled myself up into the metal basket. I reclined there, my back cupped by the curved walls. Above me, nighttime was a cluttered room, the moon chipped and swollen, stars dusty around it. I lay cradled in the dish, staring up into those greater, more resilient bodies. Then I stiffened myself and waited for signal.
Broadcast from the studios of KUAR in Little Rock, you've been listening to Arts and Letters. Thanks for joining us. To check out past episodes, go to artsandlettersradio.org. Leave us a comment there and let us know what you've thought about the program. Thank you to composers, singers, and songwriters. Future elevators. And Whitman Bransford. Thank you to actor Nat Vandiver for supplying the fatherly voice. Thank you to Sticky's Rock and Roll Chicken Shack for keeping music alive and well in Arkansas. Generous funding for this episode was provided by the Arkansas Humanities Council and the National Endowment for the Humanities. A special thanks to Arkansas writer Woody Skinner for gathering together 1,000 distant radios and sharing and elucidating for us his story, Preferred Signals, 1985. This show is dedicated to the wonderful and wise William Wagner, without whose preferred signals, KUAR would not remain on the air. For Arts and Letters, I'm J. Bradley Minnick. Let's heed the words of interpretive semiotician Umberto Eco. I believe that what we become depends on what our fathers teach us at odd moments when they aren't trying to teach us. We are formed by little scraps of wisdom.